Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi officially welcomes Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Tehran. The two are holding talks on regional and bilateral issues. Heads of G7 leading economies kicking off their summit in Germany with a ban on imports of Russian gold to be taken up at the talks. Plus, Hamas warning of U.S. plots for the inclusion of Israel into regional coalitions to undermine resistance in Palestine and elsewhere in the region. Good to have you with us. Our top story, Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi is in Iran for high-level talks. Minutes ago, he received an official welcome at Tehran's Sadabad Palace. The Iraqi Prime Minister, who leads a political and economic delegation, will discuss regional and bilateral issues during his stay. Now, the trip is made a day after he traveled to Saudi Arabia in a bid to revive talks between Riyadh and Tehran to ease years of tension. In the Arab Kingdom, Kadhimi held talks with the de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, on bilateral ties and efforts to boost regional security and stability. Saudi Arabia severed ties with Iran in 2016. The latest round of talks between the two countries was in April. The group of seven leading economies doubling down their support for Ukraine by saying they will no longer import gold from Russia. In a united move to cut up Moscow's finances, the G7 leaders announced the decision shortly after their summit got underway in Germany's Bavarian Alps hours ago. According to the White House, Russia accounts for around 5% of all gold exports, and 90% of that was sold to G7 countries. A centerpiece of the three-day summit will be growing energy shortages, as well as rising global energy prices worsened by the Kiev-Moscow conflict. Also on the agenda are the global food crisis and climate change. Thousands of police officers are tasked with ensuring security. Just a day ahead of the summit, some 4,000 people turned out in Munich for a largely peaceful rally. There were minor reports of the scuffles with police, though. The protesters want a phasing out of fossil fuels, social justice, and efforts to combat hunger. Now, moving on, a wave of airline strikes is hitting Europe amid a widespread labor unrest across the continent. Airline staff in Britain, Italy, France, and Spain are staging walkouts, demanding better pay and working conditions. Hundreds of flights have been canceled due to staff shortages. In Spain, the transport union is saying that the strike and staff are being replaced by temporary workers brought in from other countries. But the action is criticized for violating the right to strike. Earlier this week, some 40,000 railway workers in the UK staged a three-day strike over pay disputes, affecting thousands of commuters. Concerns are growing about a summit of strikes across Europe. The continent is currently suffering from the skyrocketing inflation and stagnant economic growth. The aviation industry is already under pressure due to staff shortages caused by mass layoffs during the pandemic. Protests and strikes go on in Italy as the country is suffering from sharply rising energy costs and growing inflation. Movements and associations representing different layers of society protest in the capital of Rome on Friday, demanding better working conditions. Max Civita reports.
As Italy's socioeconomic conditions worsen by the day, the country is witnessing an endless number of protests and strikes. On Friday, the Italian Association of Private Construction and Building Technicians staged a protest against the government's decision to suspend the so-called Superbonus scheme. The measure, which granted homeowners access to a tax credit of up to 110% on the cost of upgrading their home, was introduced in 2020 in an attempt to counter the nefarious effects on the economy of the COVID crisis.
This bonus was a real blessing for us. Finally, after decades, we stopped lowering our bids. But suddenly, not only the price of building materials sharply increased, but also the government stopped funding the scheme under the pretext that some companies were cheating.
The government should be ashamed. Building companies are going bankrupt. 200,000 workers will soon lose their job. We are furious.
Meanwhile, taxi drivers across Italy have staged the umpteenth strike action, disrupting traffic in several cities. Taxi drivers are on the warpath with the government over an EU directive which aims at liberalizing the sector.
The National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, has said
household consumer confidence has plummeted in June amidst great preoccupation for energy rising costs and for the ramifications of the Ukraine crisis. Quite surprisingly, consumer confidence is up for the second consecutive month. Also on Friday, USB-based union staged a protest at the Ministry of Economic Development against, quote, Italy's unsustainable precarization of work. USB says young Italians are only offered temporary, badly paid jobs.
In Italia sono 30 anni che...
Salaries in Italy haven't grown for over 30 years. Nevertheless, military spending is on the rise. Ours is the EU country with the highest number of contracts regulating badly paid casual work.
Italians are also very worried about the water drought that has afflicted the country over the past weeks. Several regions are mulling over introducing water rationing to manage the limitation of water. The Lombardy region on Friday declared a state of emergency for drought after water levels in the Po River fell by over three quarters amid the worst drought in 70 years. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's president has slammed the recent anti-Tehran resolution by the IAEA Board of Governors, saying that a measure won't force the country to back down from its stance in the Vienna talks.
Negotiations will continue. We don't want to stop the talks, but we have said many times that this resolution cannot force us to back down from a stance. Our negotiators will engage in dignified negotiations to restore the rights of the Iranian people. This has been stressed in meetings with European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell.
In a televised interview, Raisi said that the improper resolution was put forth while Iran was in the middle of the JCPOA revival talks and collaborating fully with the International Atomic Energy Agency. The comments were made shortly after Iran's foreign minister and EU foreign policy chief met in Tehran and announced talks on reviving the deal will resume in the coming days. Joseph Borrell also met with the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Ali Shamkhani told him that Iran's remedial measures in the nuclear sector are a legal and rational response to U.S. unilateralism and Europe's inaction. Newer news that's affiliated with the National Security Council says the next round of talks will likely be held in Doha.
It takes an in-person visit to Iran by the EU foreign policy chief now to revitalize the ailing 2015 deal between Iran and world powers. Josep Borrell said his two-day trip to Tehran is aimed at removing the last remaining roadblocks to concluding the Vienna talks, which have been at a stalemate since March this year.
My visit has one main objective. It was to break the current dynamic of escalation and to break the stalemate of the negotiations on the JCPOA.
The talks in Vienna began in April last year with the aim of returning the United States to the 2015 deal and ensuring Tehran's full compliance with its commitments. The negotiations have been stalled since March amid differences between Tehran and Washington. Iran says the United States, which is not directly engaged in the talks, must remove all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance with the accord.
We hope that the Americans will this time be realistic and act responsibly on the path toward achieving an agreement.
Borrell says it's in no one's interest that the pause in the talks persists, urging Tehran and Washington to resume the talks as soon as possible.
There are decisions that have to be taken in Tehran and in Washington. But we agreed today that this visit will be followed by the resumption of negotiations also between Iran and U.S., facilitated by my team to try to solve the last outstanding issues.
Iran welcomed Borrell's call. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says his country is ready to resume the talks within the next few days.
First of all, Iran is ready to get back to the talks in the coming days. Secondly, what is important for the Islamic Republic is that Iran should enjoy the economic benefits promised under the agreement that was signed in 2015.
Iran started to scale back its obligations to the 2015 deal following Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the accord in 2018 and its ensuing imposition of sanctions on Iran. That triggered a series of talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal in Vienna to salvage the accord.
The Vienna discussions have for months been in limbo as a result of serious demands that neither sides of the bargain are willing to give up on. However, Borrell sees a glimmer of hope at the end of the tunnel, promising to help Tehran and Washington sort out the last remaining issues when the talks will resume in the upcoming days. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Time now for the news review. A senior Palestinian resistance official is warning that an upcoming visit by U.S. President Biden to the region is aimed at undermining the Palestinian struggle against the Israeli occupation. The head of the Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, says the visit is also part of efforts to increase Israel's clout. Biden will travel to Israel in mid-July, and from there he'll directly fly to Saudi Arabia. And he also called for the unity and integration of all resistance fronts in the region to counter Israeli infiltration. He warned of U.S.-Israeli plots for regional realignments that go beyond normalization deals with some Arab countries. And he says that involves the inclusion of Israel in regional military and security coalitions to counter the resistance front in Palestine and across the region. Now, joining me to discuss this and shed some light on it are a couple of people, our own correspondent in Gaza, Ashraf Shannon is joining us. Also, Barry Grossman, he's a political analyst, joining us from Bali, Indonesia. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Ashraf, tell us how the Palestinian factions and people look at this plan and regard it.
Well, Behrouz, Palestinians consider all U.S. presidents, whether Trump or Biden, any U.S. president, as part of an international conspiracy against the Palestinians. And that the visit by Joe Biden in mid-July will only aims to undermine the Palestinian cause. Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh was speaking to the National Islamic Conference in Beirut when he talked about the importance of strengthening all forms of resistance on all fronts. He mainly talked about six fronts: Gaza, the occupied West Bank, occupied Palestine, E-48, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. According to the Hamas senior official, the visit aims to create an alliance to foil the Palestinian resistance and to undermine Palestinian efforts to liberate their lands. Haniyeh called for strengthening the axis of resistance against the Israeli regime members.
Okay. Now, Barry, it's been quite a while. They've been talking about this so-called alliance. It's not the first day. I wonder what has pushed them to get more serious and do something, and what's the plan like? Hamas is warning this is even more dangerous than the so-called normalization deals with Tel Aviv.
Well, look, the way things work is that all of the hard work is done before these meetings at the presidential level take place. And if we actually look at the so-called Abraham Accords signed in 2020 by both the United Arab Emirates and the occupation, by its terms, that treaty, and it's very much a formal treaty, actually speaks about obligations to cooperate in order to maintain security in the region and to cooperate militarily. And it contemplates very clearly that the provisions of the Abraham Accords will take precedence over any domestic law within the United Arab Emirates or any policy position which is at odds with it. And moreover, that the Emirates will prepare themselves to take part in an initiative led by the United States to usher in an understanding, if you like, I think they call it the strategic agenda for the Middle East, whereby the parties all come together in order to work together to, among other things, maintain and achieve security in the region and to fight what they would call terrorism in the region. So this is actually not just about the Palestinian resistance, but the wider axis of resistance. I'm very sad to say that certainly as far as the political apparatus goes, within the Sunni world, many Arab League countries have let the Palestinians down terribly. And the move is now afoot, if you like, to motivate the political establishment in leading Arab League countries to work with the United States and indeed with the occupation to oppose all resistance in the region, including the Palestinian resistance, but the wider resistance movement against U.S. hegemony. So I agree wholeheartedly with what Mr. Haniyeh had to say. I think the real takeaway from his comments is that the time has come for unity between the different branches of the axis of resistance, bearing in mind that it's been very clear for quite a long time now that the plan that's afoot is for the U.S. and other Atlantic world countries, together with Saudi Arabia and Israel, to potentially criminalize Hezbollah and that branch of the axis of resistance in order to make sure that Hamas is isolated and to help essentially the occupation achieve its objectives in continuing to take over Palestinian lands.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this episode of the News Reveal. Let me thank our guests. We had Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent in Gaza City, and Barak Grossman, political analyst in Bali, Indonesia. And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, three-quarters of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking, as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that, because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called Track Trace, and here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking and tracking and tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbor. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sin, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck, and then if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbour every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one custom administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States so important work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in New Territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste has crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guayu.
When we went to the Guayu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guayu, but we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know we arrived at Guayu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. No. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guayu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic. and classify different types.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead, and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really, what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year. But it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guiyu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world. And this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a higher resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. It will take time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. My Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Aramejo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbor, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they will look at it as condemned goods, so you are not going to pay the value that you would pay ordinarily.
At Tema Harbor, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
Many of my footage, you see the SEPS officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on the second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbor controls fail to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers, we need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold, 300 million PCs, and 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time, before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah the Kind. Dear brothers and sisters, Salamun alaikum. You are listening to this program, Lantern, from IRIB English Radio. On the continuation of Lantern, we'll listen to an interesting story. A lion have been watching three bullocks feeding in an open field. He had tried to attack them several times, but they had kept together and helped each other to drive him off. The lion had little hope of eating them, for he was not watch for three strong bullocks with their sharp horns and hoofs. But he could not keep away from that field, for it is hard to resist watching a good meal even when there is little chance of getting it. Then one day the bullocks had a quarrel, and when the hungry lion came to look at them and lick his chops as he was accustomed to do, he found them in separate corners of the field as far away from one another as they could get. It was now an easy matter for the lion to attack them one at a time, and this he proceeded to do with the greatest satisfaction and relish. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin asta'in. The Holy Quran and the necessity of integration. As we know, in all communities, there are some common points and shared cultural traits. And at the same time, some fractions of the same community may appear not to share in some respects with each other. However, in this regard, we find that in the Holy Quran, the case of integration and integrity have always been insisted. In the Holy Quran, it's meant that not only all Muslims, but also all people should believe in the unicity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because so long as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala dispatched prophets for all people, and the aim of dispatching prophets to all peoples and all nations, all communities, has been one and the same, to invite everybody to believe in the unicity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the basic building block in the formation and in the development of all religions. As such, it's indicated that all divine religions share in one and the same doctrine and principle, that is the unicity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. On the other hand, the other point that should be indicated is that all the divine prophets, whether major prophets or minor prophets, all of them have come to invite people to two basic articles of faith. One of them is the unicity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and another one is belief in the day of resurrection and the day of judgment. So we find that on the one hand, belief in the unicity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala makes the building block or the foundational stone of all the divine religions, and at the same time, belief in the day of judgment and in the final day acts as a barrier against all people not to commit wrongdoings against people and not to commit oppression against other people. Based on this, we find that all the divine religions have been directed into one and the same path as delineated by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Another parameter in this regard is that in the Holy Quran, the cases of differences and discrimination amongst other peoples has been highlighted. in the Holy Quran, it's indicated that never try to be like those former nations, peoples, who got dispersed and they insisted on the differences. And since they've insisted on the differences and that they got dispersed, they lost their own power, because this in this social power comes after belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and then it rests upon integrity. Since it's related to integrity, we find that this integration is a very important and seminal common point and social bondage that keeps all people together. According to leading Quran exegetes, the Jews and Christians were amongst those people who insisted on their own differences, on the differences and discriminations and, the discrepancies, among available in their own communities.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So we find that they got dispersed, in the former stages of their own development. At the same time, it's indicated here when people, when people get integrated with each other, little by little they come to forget their own differences, and they come to develop very important ideas regarding their own future. Not only regarding their own future, but also regarding the future of all other nations. Again, imagine that, for example, even in some industrially leading communities and countries, we find that despite some differences among them, the greater and top-ranking policymakers and leaders have shaped the companies in such a way that despite all the differences certainly available among them, they've been leading a certain path. And because of this, they've made great improvements in the industries. It's improper to talk about social status, or, for example, the status of social moralities among them. Now here, for the time being, stress is on the industrial development. At the same time, clinging to the bond of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is very much important, as indicated in the Ayatul Kursi in the Holy Quran. When the Holy Quran says "wa'tasimu bihablillah," it means that you stick or cling very fast to the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It means that, this is of course a metaphor. However, it means that everybody, not all communities in general, but individually speaking, all people are expected to appeal to the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in order to get united with each other, and together with each other they should be united around the pillar of the Islamic religion. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.